Today's episode is brought to you by Slayhouse Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Hey everybody, it's Jeremy from Slayhouse Publishing presents Lit Bits, and I'm always patting myself on the back that I get it right, even though our guest today said that she got it right on the first try.
All right, I wouldn't say first try. Like, I definitely have screwed it up talking to my Alexa more than once, but I've got it down now.
I feel like you're approaching the point where you've gotten it right more times than you've gotten it wrong. But
probably.
You got it wrong so spectacularly.
We're never going to forget it.
I'm never going to.
I didn't even think about that from an Alexa point of view.
Like, so I have to say, like, Alexa, play Slayhouse Publishing Presents Lit Bits Podcast. New episode. And you have to say all of that or it doesn't play. If you just like drop the podcast, it just says like cannot find. So you have to say the whole thing.
I'm learning new things.
Yeah.
I love it. That's my goal. Yeah, that was my goal.
Just freak Alexa out.
Yeah.
That was the naming process. I
screwed up a lot, but now I have mastered it.
We're joined today by a very special guest who is actually with us in the studio.
In the studio.
Kay West, author of Wild Things Will Roam.
Yes.
Yeah, that's me.
So our brief little intro that we're going to go by is Kay West likes to create worlds readers can get lost in, writing stories for people who want to believe in magic and like to have their hearts broken. All right. And her debut novel, Wild Things Will Roam, is available now online everywhere books are sold. When she's not writing, she's a mom of two, moonlighting as a cover and graphic design artist. I should have put a space there. The two that you're a mom to aren't moonlighting as the
correct,
cover and graphic
correct.
Design
There's
artist.
A pause. Yeah,
you need a comma.
Yeah. gym owner and yoga instructor while also working daylight hours as an IT professional.
Yeah.
So welcome. You are busy.
Lots of hats being worn.
Lots of hats. I have a really big head, so that helps. They're just a bunch of small hats sewn together into one hat that I'm wearing.
So how did you get into writing?
It's always the first question, and I never know the answer. It's like a minor existential crisis. Like, who am I, and what do I do? How do you get into writing? Well, they start sometime in, I think, kindergarten, first grade, and they help you with that. And then after a while, you start to perfect the art. No,
we went really technical there.
Sorry.
That was a really good answer.
I started writing in school, and I think my experience there was, I think like most people who end up writing things, is that someone somewhere was like, you're pretty good at this, you should write. And then you get real cocky about that. And you're like, I should write. And then you do, and you're like, this is amazing. And then you give it to people, and they're like, it's trash. And you're like, oh my God, it is trash. And then, then you have to like totally backpedal, and then again, the existential crisis part two, who am I? Why would I even do this? And then eventually you get past that hurdle and you're like, this is something I like. But I started writing this book specifically after writing lots of books that did not go anywhere. And I started this one with some friends after I had a dream, and I was like texting them about the dream, and we just kind of went back and forth, and it became this novel idea. And then that just jokingly, I was like, I'm going to pin the first like couple pages and send it to him because we made this whole big stupid banter thing. And then, the first pages weren't terrible. And it just kind of kept going after that. And it was, you know, 150
That's incredible.
Pages
long.
Awesome.
I mean, incredible is a stretch, but I'll take it. Thank you. Yeah.
No, I mean, living the dream, really.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. You make your life. You got to manifest it. So.
Yeah. So this was your debut novel.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit about, you know, kind of the process of trying to discover what you were doing with the characters, discover what you were doing with the story.
Sure, yeah.
What were some of the pitfalls that you kind of fell into through this process, and how did you work your way out of that, you know, to create this novel?
Sure. So I think perspective was the very first major pitfall. So I was doing a lot of head hopping at first, thinking that I had an understanding of what it meant to be like a third person omniscient narrator, but it just kind of came across as real like, whose head am I in? This is very confusing. And then I got some notes back on that from someone who was like, ah, this is terrible. I was like, oh, you're right. Oh my God, you're right. So then I went back and started to actually play around with perspective. And I think that was the big lesson learned for me I rewrote this book. I learned to write on this book. And I rewrote it probably 7 different times as far as like,
oh, wow.
Like almost starting from scratch and being like, I'm going to like grab pieces that I like, but the rest of this is trash. Lots of trash, lots of trash talk. The perspective part. So the last few times, every time it got a pass, it got a pass from a different character's perspective. And so I would put in these like placeholders where, you know, I'd be telling it from one character's, like we're talking about, you know, Liv, right? We started the whole thing from Liv's perspective, came back, fleshed out Lash as a person, and then came back and then added in Ander. And it was one of those things where as I wrote out scenes, I would discover more and more about each person and then have to make adjustments based on like, oh, this person wouldn't actually do that. Like in the Liv version, this placeholder version of Lash might do this, but the actual person Lash would never do this. And so then it kind of evolved that way. And so I got to the point where I could use the perspectives to say different things because they noticed different things.
That is such a fascinating process for me to see like the characters grow and evolve and become like they start dictating their own actions, their own change, their own behaviors.
Oh, they make decisions. You just set the scene and they do the thing.
Well, I think it's really interesting too that each of the different characters kind of see the other characters very differently. You know, when Liv interacts with Lash and Ander, right? Mm-hmm. The brothers. She has a very different like vision of who they are in comparison to what they think of themselves.
Absolutely.
And I think that not many novels that I've seen with multiple perspectives really kind of give us that kind of a scope, right? I think it's a really kind of performative act of writing, but also as a reader, it's really interesting to live in that headspace and then kind of encounter these different characters very differently. It gives them a bit more dimension, I think, right?
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. So that's something I set out to do specifically is to explore that disconnect between what your internal monologue, how that influences the way that you're perceived. And so like you think of yourself a certain way based on what you are hearing or seeing inside your head. But then how that comes across might be vastly different. I think Lash is a good example of that. That like,
oh, definitely.
He's kind of anxiety riddled and like very insecure, but it comes across very much like an asshole.
Yeah.
And like those are not.
Well, that's what I did. That's what I did enjoy about your book. I did enjoy.
I'll take it. So
many genre stories out there. The characters are just so flat and so one dimensional, and to have that kind of multi-person perspective in this is really, really refreshing because it personalizes the outside world that's kind of encroaching on them in this.
Yeah, we've talked about genre work, you know, previously, and some of what makes genre work good or what makes genre work kind of bad. I think a lot of genre writers think that everything has to be really plot driven. You know, we were talking to Amakatsu last week,
mm-hmm.
And
she said she didn't like the idea of like genre versus literary. She said what makes it literary are the characters for her. So
right.
So it sounds like you're taking kind of the same approach to it, or kind of.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you're asking whether or not I'm plot-driven, the answer to that is absolutely not. I write and then come back and I'm like, oh, shit, plot. And then have to, like, that's why there were 7 drafts of this book.
I gotta figure out what happens.
Uh-huh, what's actually happening here.
So I often think about, like, the utility of fiction, mm-hmm. right? This has been something of, like, my recent obsession is trying to track what is the utility of fiction.
Yeah.
What does it add to our lives? And I think especially because your book is a specific subgenre of like post-apocalyptic fiction.
It is, yeah.
So can we dig in just a little bit? What does post-apocalyptic fiction mean for you? And why do you think that, you know, in a world of like a pandemic, right? stuff like this is really kind of heavy.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, what can this genre kind of give to us? How do we interact with it fruitfully?
Yeah. So it's interesting you mentioned that. So post-apocalyptic, This is a post-apocalyptic novel, and I always refer to it as being kind of post-war, because for some reason, back to that internal, like, perception versus external perception, it never felt like a post-apocalyptic book for me. And then people be like, oh yeah, it's like this post-apocalypse. And I'm like, oh, like I'm picturing Mad Max. And I'm like, well, I feel like it's not like that. But I also very much understate how violent it is too. So people will be like, oh, this book's very violent. And I'm like, it is? And then I like start thinking about it. And I'm like, oh, I guess so. I just like, it doesn't resonate with me that way, which, you know, just kind of sounds nonsensical now that I say that. But yeah, it's a weird time to be in dystopia, to answer your question. The book actually released on the episodic platform in March of 2020. So if you're curious what else was going on in the world, there was the start of a major pandemic. And so it was an interesting time. There are definitely some thematic elements in it that life started to kind of imitate art for me, and I was like, oh, this is not. It felt weird to promote because I felt like people were very traumatized by what was happening around us. And so it felt bad to be like, hey, if you are just lost in trauma, here's some extra trauma for you if you just want that. But but to your point, I think the purpose that this kind of novel serves is one that is cathartic. I think that we're obsessed and have been obsessed for a while now with this post-apocalyptic world. And we'll talk probably a little more about this when we talk about Bradbury and the Veldt, but like I think we're very disconnected from the style of living that we were designed for. And so we feel this like kind of uselessness, and we long for this desire to be able to perform these skills that we like to think we have, right? And so for me, that was a lot of the setting. I wanted it to be relatively modern, but I wanted it to be in a wilderness. And how do I get people in a wilderness in a modern setting? And so it was just like by necessity post-war, which is probably why I'm not very good at thinking of it like a post-apocalypse. But but yeah, I mean, we had that obsession for a long time. We're doomsday, you know, fantasizers. We want the world to end a little bit, because then one, we're no longer responsible for all the trivial daily stuff that we're like bogged down by, but also because we like to think that like I would totally be good at these things. I'll be honest with you guys, I would absolutely not. I would be a disaster in a disaster situation. I'd be like, I have some Wikipedia knowledge on how to build a toothbrush, guys, but beyond that, I'm not saving the day. So I don't know if that was a concise answer, but
no, it's great. It's that gets me thinking, because I think then about that internal versus how I'm perceived. And internally, I'm like, I would be the hero of the apocalypse. You right. know, I would save everybody, and everyone else is looking at me like, man, you'd die within like 10 minutes.
Well, like, I mean, yes, that's always my concern. It's like I would panic. I am a like, what is it? Fight or flight, freeze or fawn. I am like collapse in tears. So like if something startles me, I literally curl into a ball.
I think about this a lot. I think about like, you know, survival skills. I'm like, I don't know how to slaughter a cow.
Right.
Fucking worthless.
Right. Yeah. Right.
They just stand there.
That's true. They just let you. It's real tragic.
No doubt.
Yeah, no, it's a and I got lucky in this book because, you know, it kind of filtered out the sort of people who would survive. And so like the Farrow brothers ended up being Romani American by virtue of necessity also later. Like they didn't originally start that way. Mm-hmm. And then it was like trying to find people with skill sets that like would be conducive to this. But then also there is a lot of room for error that I'm like, well, they maybe just wouldn't know either, so it's fine. Like I don't know and they probably don't know. So we're just going to build that in and pretend that it's fine.
So another thing that we found pretty interesting about your book was kind of the reliance on non-Eurocentric mythology. We're constantly talking about how fantasy, especially, I think as a genre, has just been like governed, ruled by Eurocentric myths For like forever. It's like, you know, Tolkien did it, and then everybody else just mirrored Tolkien for so long. And now we're starting to see some resurgence of non-Eurocentric mythologies, you know, kind of woven into the tapestry of a book. Can you share with us just a little bit of you know, what you were kind of going for with regards to, like, the Cretes that show up in your story and some of the other mythologies you weave in?
Yeah. So I think to your point about the Eurocentric stuff, that's the result of us just being culturally Eurocentric, right? Because you have all of these different disparate cultures, especially, you know, in countries like America, that have their own backgrounds and their own mythologies. But at least in my case, I'm a descendant. My grandmother's from the Philippines. And so in our case, there was this mythology that belonged to the people that was stripped of them by colonialization in the 1600s. And so, like, for me, there's been this, like, big interest in rediscovering some of that. But also, that's a rediscovery as a culture. It's not just something that... like, I didn't happen to know. No one knows it. So people are trying to piece together from, like, documentation, like, what existed prior to the Spanish settlement. And it's, I don't know, it's really interesting. So back to the Eurocentric thing. That's why I think we lean that way, because Europe kind of took over the world. And people, that's what was written down.
Right.
So Filipino. And I am very... I've gotten really down this rabbit hole. I actually stumbled onto Filipino mythology accidentally. So I was trying to plug in some stuff, and one of the main characters in my book, Liv, is Filipino, as a recommendation from a friend of mine, because she was like, hey, you know, I originally wrote her to be blonde. And then my friend was like, why don't you make her Filipino? Because there's, like, none of you. And I was like, that's a great idea. And so, you know, that's literally what happened. I know. I wish it were deeper than that. Like, I wish I had some, like, moral, like, this is why I'm doing this. But it was truly a recommendation from someone else. And I was like, okay.
I mean, not to cut you off.
You can cut me off, please.
Is that not necessary? I mean, like I don't know. I feel like there are so many blonde protagonists, and yet, you know, like, there are also a lot of Filipino kids who would like to see themselves reflected in fiction.
Yeah.
So, you know, and maybe not even Filipino kids, but sure, kids who are not blonde kids who want to see more diverse representation of themselves on screen or in a book or in a story.
Well, I think that it's interesting you say that, because, again, it speaks to where my lens was at when I started this, right? That, like, I wanted to write a book that had a female protagonist, and even that stretch was that she was, like, white and blonde. Like, that was as far as my brain could stretch to be like, ah, yes, this protagonist. And so it took me a while to, like, wrap my head around, like, oh, yeah, there isn't, like, there's so little diversity that I wasn't even trying to picture myself in the story. Like, I wasn't even thinking about, you know, plugging myself in that way, the way you resonate with a protagonist. So she had to make that statement for me. And I think there was a sense of insecurity there too, that, like, if you write a character that looks like you, now you run into that, like, well, this is obviously the author insert. Like, right? And right. And so then I was like, well, I don't know if I want to do that. 'Cause, like, then that's just going to put me there. But I am glad that I did, especially because the one that I'm working on now, which is actually the prequel to this book, is very much rooted in Filipino folklore. And it's based around Liv's mother. And so it's been really cool for me, because it is more of a self-exploration, I guess, an exploration of my mom and her experience as a first-generation American and things like that. So
can you... can you tell us a little bit about Filipino mythology?
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys actually, I listened with bated breath as you went through all of your, like, vampiric monsters. I was like,
Wikipedia article that Jeremy wrote.
Yeah, so you guys were, like, going down this list, and you eventually kind of ended up in Asia. And I was like, oh, no, are they going to say it? I was like, I was waiting. And it was, like, the second to last one you mentioned was the Menin Gaul. And I was like, yes, there it is. You did it. And that is actually, so to speak on your vampirism, it is a, like, she is like a vampiric baby eater. And so, like, they disassemble themselves, and, like, their top half sprouts wings, and they leave their bottom half just, like, out in the woods. And then they fly up and, like, stick their long, spooky needle tongues in through, like, the thatched roofing of your house and steal your baby's soul. Like, just suck it right out of the belly of pregnant women. And so you have to, like, put up garlic to, like, basically it's like the adobo ingredients, like, whatever. Like, you need, like, garlic and vinegar and, like, it's interesting. But
eat your adobo.
Yeah,
you don't want to get eaten by that.
Well, but to be fair, I think it's something. So, and again, monsters, I think, always play a role for telling some sort of cultural narrative, right? And so obviously child loss is a very real thing. And it is much easier to attribute that to some, you know, spooky external factor than for it to be you know, something that is just like an act of God or just a you know, bad luck situation. It's a lot easier to say, like, evil forces did this to me. And so I think there's some solace there, but it also becomes like a fun thing for kids, like, sort of like you, like, run out, like, because you can salt the bottom half. And I think there's actually a part in Wild Things of Rome where they sort of, like, loosely brush over this, but, like, you can salt the bottom half if you find it, and then the Manannagal won't be able to reattach, and so she'll die. So she's got to be able to, like, put her torso back together, or else.
That is terrifying.
And she,
to,
like,
picture.
Lives with you, right? So she's like fair skinned, like, pretty hair, like, lives in town. Anybody could be this gal, you know.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of this weird, anyway, like, monsters among you vibe.
That's wild.
That is terrifying.
I'm just thinking about this.
So, like, these are the kind of nighttime stories that I grew up with. so it really, like, formative years. But I will say it very much went hand in hand. So I grew up religious. My mom is still a minister. My grandmother came from the Philippines, where they are predominantly Catholic. And there is very much this ability, and I would describe it now as, like, magical realism when we're talking about genre, where, like, the magic just sort of, like, also lives.
Yeah.
And that is very much the experience that is lived in cultures outside of America. And as a kid, that was really fascinating to me, that, like, that my grandmother would speak about, like, supernatural creatures and, like, superstitions alongside her faith, like, they weren't disparate. Like, they were they were very much two sides of the same coin for her. And I, as a kid, did not understand how you could do that, because they seemed like they were two very opposing forces. And so that's actually a lot of what started on this storyline. Was my husband was like, you know, everybody always says, write what you know. Like, you know a bunch of weird shit, put it in there. So I did, yeah. He offers, honestly, the best advice. Like, don't tell jokes, you're not funny. but yeah, so I did. I started writing that in there because I did have all these kind of fun, spooky things. My grandmother used to terrorize us because she thought it was funny, which is fine. That's why I collapse when I'm scared. it's fine. But yeah, so that kind of interwoven relationship is something I wanted to explore. And I think, to your earlier point, that is something that people are hungry for, because we've seen the Greek gods. Like, we get them. We know them. We could probably identify them by photo. Like, you know, I get Apollo needs to be blonde. Like, that's, you know, I got energy there. But I think, there's a lot of similar or just as interesting stories that exist in these other cultures, and people are hungry for that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think you're right. I know that, I continue to look forward to, you know, discovering fantasy books. I think that you know, show me something I don't know, because I mean maybe it's just the world lit professor in me who's just constantly, you know, every semester I change my set of readings to include something I know nothing about, because I want to have that process of discovery alongside my students, where, you know, we can kind of experience something new together. And and also, I want to model for them, you know, what curiosity looks like, and basically
not have the answer.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It, like, to find your answer, to try to contextualize things, to contextualize stories, and I think that we just need more of that. I mean, we're a global community, so why is it that there's only one kind of level of discourse? with regards to our culture that we continue to see when there's so much more to offer, right?
Right, right. And I think we're kind of scrambling to relearn that, which is something that is, you've talked about themes, like you have like themes you're aiming for, and then you have like the secondary themes that just right. sort of evolve out. And I feel like Wild Things Will Roam very much became about lost culture on accident. Like that was something that I didn't realize I was trying to explore until I got there and was like, oh yeah, like there is truly this sense of like, this is almost a dark age now. We've got culture, we've got mm-hmm. memory of culture, but like what does acting it out look like? And I think in the world that we are living in now, in the way things are changing so quickly around us, there's that same sense of like, you're rooted in your day-to-day task. Like this is, I'm getting up and I'm going through the motions and this is what I'm doing. And then at the end of every day, everything has changed so much that you don't even really grasp it until, you know, months have passed and you look back and you're like, wow, I'm different. Everything's so different. And I feel like the characters in these stories have had that similar experience as far as like, they have been, you know, head down doing the work and just looked up and are like, what? The yeah. hell.
I think that's kind of like the quintessential anxiety of our moment, right? Mm-hmm. I know that there was a
I want to see more of that actually in dystopian fiction.
Yeah, I think there's a it serves a purpose too, yeah. right? I think that it was Marshall Berman. He wrote a book called like All That Is Solid Melts Into Air or something like that. Taken from Marx, right?
Sure.
But he basically kind of talks about like the modern anxiety is just the fact that the world changes so dramatically mm-hmm. from day to day, and the average person cannot keep up with the change that we kind of undergo. And so in a way, I think perhaps the dystopian premise helps mm-hmm. us try to like reorient ourselves to the moment we live in or the lives that we lead, because if we can understand that process, then perhaps we may equip ourselves to better deal with the world as we see and experience it.
Yeah, I think, so your question on like what purpose do you think it serves? So horror does this, right? Horror does this well, which is that it explores things you are afraid of in a context where you are relatively safe. It's like why we like horror mm-hmm. movies, because like I get the rush of being scared without actually being in perilous danger. And I think that is, it allows us to explore not only those emotions or the hypotheticals of it, but to get that release of like, I have this anxiety, I need it to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I need to do something with it. And so we seek that kind of thrill or catharsis to just like have an outlet. It's like why you watch, you know, The Family Stone at Christmas and cry. That might be very specific. That might just be me, but that movie makes me cry every time. And it always feels real good because it's an anxiety, right? Like you're like, oh yeah, I also am scared of losing family members or whatever, you know? And you're like, oh, let me get this out so that I don't have to just dwell.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the fiction that inspired you in writing okay. Wild Things Will Roam. I think Jeremy kind of identified that Richard Matheson was maybe an
You
influence.
Mentioned it to me,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
I Am Legend.
I mean, yeah, that's the opening scene, right? They're tossing bodies into a pit. So I don't, yeah. And I remember you guys talking about I Am Legend, and I want y'all to know that I was listening at home on my Alexa product placement, and I was like wanting to talk back to y'all. And was like, I can't do that because they can't hear me. This is pre-recorded. I'm in my kitchen washing dishes, and I'm like, okay, but. And I was like, no, that's fine. That's fine. Head down. They don't hear you.
Send us angry mail. I love that.
Yeah.
No. It was fine. But yeah. So it's absolutely a heavy inspiration because in I Am Legend, you know, he walks past these pits where they had burned the bodies effectively. And that was something that was very clear to me from the very beginning, was like, what do you do with dead bodies? And that seemed like a very useful and practical way to dispose of people. But like, how long would those run for? I mean, literally, it's kind of wild to think about, honestly. But so that was, I mean, from the get-go, we start with Liv in the prologue next to a pit. I mean, they are burning bodies. So that's mm-hmm. step one. But also, and y'all talked a little bit about this when you talked about the films or the adaptations, that the novel I Am Legend is very introspective, right? Yes. And it is that same disconnect. What he perceives himself to be and the way he is perceived by the world at large are vastly different. And what the work of it looks like for him, day-to-day monotony and like the actual labor that goes into being a legend is not your superhero, like fighting crime. Like he's not blowing up buildings and he's not like living life on the edge in this big, like The Rock level adrenaline rush, right? He's not smoldering at any point. He's literally like reboarding up his windows and listening to the vampires taunt him. And he's like doing his day to day. And so anyway, that part was always super fascinating to me. I think that's why adaptations fail on it. Because I think that it's difficult to capture introspection and lack of dialogue in a way that is interesting in film.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was my 2 cents on y'all's whole spiel. I was like, no, I have feelings about this.
You're totally right. I was really struck by how mad I got at some of the adaptations. You know, with the Charlton Heston movie, I feel like what they were trying to do was like kind of take this story and re-allegorize it for their political moment.
Yes.
Because that movie, I think, came in the 60s, maybe? Yeah. Omega Man?
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I was going to say 50s or 60s, somewhere.
I think it's the 60s.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly which year. I could Google it.
I'll say shit. But, all right, look that up real quick.
Yeah, but I think like 60s sci-fi, you know, was really a lot more...
71.
Oh, 71, even later. Okay.
Well, but you have to remember, 71 is also still the 60s, right?
Yeah,
because it's not, it's not a hard delineation at 1970.
Right, we roll into
like two or three.
Right. Yeah. So I think breathing from 60s sci-fi, right? Like it's all about like trying to re-allegorize for what's going on at that moment. And the late 60s, especially, was a moment of like real hotbed racial tension.
Yes.
Right. So,
and the Vietnam War.
And the Vietnam, we can't forget the war as well.
There was a very tumultuous time in America.
Yeah, so I think Omega Man is trying to have a conversation, especially about, you know, race relations. And it becomes a lot more about, gosh, even like the narrative of like the white savior. Because, oh man, that it's so heavy-handed at the end there.
There's no other role for Charlton Heston, I feel like. Like, if there ever was a white savior, I mean, besides obviously Jesus, who was white, there is Charlton Heston.
we need to call Rich Handley back and have a conversation about Charlton Heston and Planet of the Apes.
Oh my gosh, that's the best plot twist. I don't care how many times that's been parodied. Like that was when it happened, it was excellent.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. But I think that's kind of just the moment. And I think that when we recontextualize something in an adaptation, not always is it bad, but I also think like, you know, it kind of fundamentally transforms the experience, and that transformation isn't always like the best choice.
I think though it has to, right? So I started in my naivete, when I started writing Wild Things Will Roam, I was like, I want to write something that will stand the test of time, as one does, right? It's very arrogant. You're like, I'm gonna write something that'll last forever. And then I had these like stupid little references I really wanted to include, and I realized that you can't do anything that's not of the moment you are in. Like that is your lens. That is where you are. And so adaptation, you know, the book was written. And then the adaptation came several years later. And so they're looking at it from a totally different lens. And what it meant to them at that cultural moment is what they translated it to, whether they meant to or not. Like, that's, like, you can't avoid that. I don't think you separate yourself from it. So, anyway, Omega Man. And then I think, which one's the one with Vincent Price? I feel like that one was the one that was, like, the most closely tied to it, because it's like narration, just long-winded narration. And then I'm drawing a total blank on it, so that's fine.
I'm not even sure if I've seen that one.
Which
is like shocking, because I feel like I have seen everything Vincent Price has ever been in. He was one of those, like,
did I dream this and make it up?
No, I'm not. I don't think you I mean, I have gaps in my knowledge for sure.
Now I have to know. Give me a moment. Last Man on Earth. 1964, you know Last Man on Earth.
Okay. I don't think I've seen that one.
Okay, it's the closest because it is just long-winded narration about him doing day-to-day tasks, and it's very boring, no offense, because it is truly just a narrator, him narrating the actions he does, which is what happens in the book, but it makes sense in a book, and it's different for the screen, and I think that's why we ended up with the Robert Morgan of the Will Smith version.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He doesn't even have the same name.
No. I really dislike that movie. I really, really do.
I like it, but you have to like it for something separate from the
And maybe
book.
That's just my problem is, like, I can't separate
you
the
You can't
two.
Separate it.
Yeah, I really can't. Yeah.
It's translated for a cultural moment. Plus those beautiful landscape scenes of buildings overwrought with vines. I'm here for that always.
Yeah. So we... I think the consensus is we all can appreciate I Am Legend.
maybe on different
levels, at least the book, right?
Oh, I love that book, though.
We have a different view of Matheson's
Hell House.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
You heard us talking about it, and you were I've definitely got some thoughts about this. So I'm like, I've got to ask her then. I've got to find out.
I don't think she's alone, because I know that some of our Twitter followers also, they're like, Hell House is my favorite book. And I'm like, fucking how? Because I have hot takes about that book.
I do too. So Hell House, So I read Hell House quickly. I very quickly devoured Hell House, and I feel like it was entertaining and very I had to see where it was going, so it worked on that front. The problem with Hell House, and I think that this is maybe my biggest insecurity as someone who has written something that is now out there for people to read, is that Hell House revealed more to me about Matheson that I didn't like than I wanted to know about Matheson. I feel like it told me more about the author than I wanted to know about him, as a person.
So what did you learn?
Well, I mean, so I feel like it went very out of its way to be shocking. And it's very much like a Rob Zombie film, I think, like a literary, shock value. Value.
Oh man. I want to
go ahead.
Hot takes. You ready?
Let's do it.
Hot takes.
Okay. So I know that the book was actually like Matheson's answer to Shirley Jackson.
Right.
Because
Shirley
Jackson is the best fucking novelist of the 20th century. I'm just convinced.
I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah. So, like, he reads this book, Haunting of Hill House, in the 50s, right? But he's too busy, like, being on fucking Twilight Zone or whatever, like, writing his other projects, right? And so he never gets around to actually writing Hell House, and then he delivers it in, like, 1970, right? Many moons afterwards, but it's his like retort, his response to Shirley Jackson. And whereas I think that Shirley Jackson's book is startling because of its like emotional complexity, and
unreliable narrator.
Definitely. But it's also just a very it's another introspective book, right?
Hard to adapt. Its adaptions have not done really well.
Yeah. So I think that he reads this book, and then it felt like his reaction was like, well, that's not fucking scary.
Yes.
And it's like, you missed the whole fucking point there, Matheson.
This is exactly right. And also, one of the things, sorry, I'm getting all like heated in my chair. The other thing is that I feel like Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House is not just scary because the house is spooky, right? Sure. It's scary in the sense of manifestation. Like, how much do you dwell on something, and does your dwelling on something make it happen? So I think that is part of that that's tied in there. But Shirley Jackson's also captures the aimlessness that I think women felt at the time. Mm-hmm. And your main character is someone who has dedicated her life to caring for her mother, who I think has recently died. Yeah. It's been a minute since I've read it, but like her mom has recently died, and this is her first foray into the world. And she is shockingly naive, and she is like, does not relate well to these other people because she's been in this codependently abusive relationship with a mother who has been domineering her life. And all of this is before the book even starts, right?
Yeah.
And that's the person whose lens we are living through. And I feel like that anxiety captured the anxiety of a generation of women who were like, what do I do with myself? Because like, I can't separate myself from my upbringing, from my duties, from my responsibilities, but there is a me inside here. And you see it from Shirley Jackson, you see it from several of the like female novelists of the era that are like, trying not to put their heads in ovens, honestly, right? Or in some cases, actually putting their heads in ovens in the case of Sylvia Plath. But like, anyway, all that to say, Matheson, I feel like, saw that and was like, I can make this scary. And it's the most like, no offense, it's like the most dude thing to do. Like he's like, it feels very like, if not misogynistic, it just feels like it missed the subtext.
I mean, I think it is straight up misogynistic.
I mean, absolutely.
I have a real difficulty with like sexual assault and depictions of sexual assault in
as one
in
should.
Horror. And
we could talk about that too.
Yeah. I feel like sexual assault in horror is. It almost feels like a last resort. It feels like you're playing your hardest card because it's like there's no other extreme we can really go to.
Right.
If we want to evoke real intense, you know, feelings of horror or something like that, especially if it's a woman character, I think that the lack of a woman's agency is, you know, like that's as far as you can go. And so many writers are just like, I'm gonna push that button as much as I can.
Right.
And I think that it's really traumatic. It's very traumatizing. And I think that it's also just like, to a certain extent, I feel like it's a little uninventive.
Yeah.
Because it's like,
agreed.
It's just malicious to a point, right? And I felt like Matheson does this really poorly in that book where his women are only defined by their sexual dimension.
Yes.
And
they're very flat otherwise.
And there's nothing else to them. And so the horror is because he strips away all of their agency completely. They don't even have agency to begin with. And then he repeatedly sexually assaults the two
women. Yep.
Women in that book.
Mm-hmm.
It frustrated the hell out of me.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, it revealed more to me, I think, about Matheson than I think he meant for it to, which is again upsetting. And I'm like, dang it, Matheson. Cause I love lots of other things of his work too. But to your point about that, that is something that I have hot takes on, right? Like you see that horror and fantasy, especially, both very heavy-handedly lean on like sexual assault of women. Like that's always the thing, which is also a bit trivializing because like men are also can be sexually assaulted. So like we push a very clear narrative that like it only happens to women, and also it's always like secondary character off screen. Like it gets you lit up, but it's like never about that person, which is something that like honestly I was trying to do in Wild Things Will Roam, is to actually look at the people behind the books. Horror and fantasy love to traumatize their characters and never actually explore what it looks like to be traumatized, or like how that affects somebody's ability to relate to other people.
That your book kind of tries to deal with this quite a bit, and I know Jeremy, like your book also deals with this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mindful of Scorpions.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Product placement.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've talked about this a little bit just privately. I don't know that we've actually talked about it on the show, but, you know, part of, I think, what you were doing with that book was again, playing with that idea of agency and the gradual loss of agency through all of the characters, and then how they try to deal with the fact that they lost that agency.
Right.
And I know I jump into, you know, we're talking about sexual assault of women, and I know, spoiler alert, the main female character, I feel like she's well-rounded. I mean, I feel like she's a strong character, but she does has that hit that point when this happens to her. this was not something I felt like when I decided to write that scene. It wasn't something that I was like, I want to glorify this kind of violence. Right. I don't want to, you know, make this look, you know, I'm not trying to just shock the horror or shock the people, because what's been on my mind, what made me start writing that book, is looking at how trauma affects people.
Right.
So each of my characters deal with the trauma that's inflicted on them in different ways. And as I've planned like a series of three books for this, they're going to be dealing with the events of the first book, even in the later books. They're, it's still right. going to be impacting them.
It and doesn't it's, go away.
And
yeah.
I think the full arc of the story, when I see this woman, this female character that I tried to create, a very strong person, that what happens to her in that first book is only a small part of her. It's how she overcomes it and becomes the stronger person.
Sure.
That's going to be really kind of showcased throughout the rest of the series. So.
Sure. And I think there's a lot to that, that character development aspect, but I also feel like it, and this is something I really struggled with in Wild Things Are Up. So there was like a point where I was like, there was two moods in the book. There was like this before, and then there was after. And like, I kept trying to cross that bridge in a different way. Like I kept trying to write different kinds of scenes that would fill that space,
yeah.
that transition. And there was nothing else. Like this is like, that was what it always was. It was like, couldn't write around it. It just died. Anytime I tried to write that scene any other way, like it was like, nope, this is what happens. And this sucks. But part of that too, is that at least for me, I want to also explore the fact that like, it's not just about overcoming things that happen to you. Like people, I think we like that idea. Like we love a good underdog story where it's like, oh, you mm-hmm. can be traumatized and then like rise above it and like overcome, you know, anything that's happened to you, you know, because of these things. It's like, well, no, you overcome in spite of these things.
Right.
But then also, you know, like what does it look like to get there? You don't just like wake up and like turn on a dial and be like, I am going to be resilient now. Like you're like, no, this fucking sucks. like.
And it's never 100% either. I mean,
right.
you're.
Right.
I don't care how the like, character in real life even is able to bring their life back together.
Right.
That trauma will manifest itself in some way throughout the rest of their life.
That's exactly.
The it's exactly. exactly. It sticks around.
Yeah.
Right. And it has very far-reaching effects
mm-hmm. yeah.
in ways that you don't, you know, necessarily immediately recognize.
Right. And on interpersonal relationships. And I think that's the
yes.
thing. Like, and we see that. Or at least I tried to convey that with like Lash in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have a character who is, again, he comes across very much like this kind of aggressive
yeah.
asshole.
Yeah.
And then you get inside of his head and he's really very, very traumatized from his past and his upbringing. And like all of these things are sort of these defenses that he's putting up without even realizing that he's doing it. And he has kind of that envy, I think, for his brother that like people just like him. And he can just walk in and be likable. And Lash is like, I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah.
Like that's, anyway.
Yeah. I, you know, to your point about that, about horror and fantasy, you know, kind of showcasing or highlighting this kind of violence and this trauma and that sort of thing. I'm trying to remember the book I read because I want to be clear. I mean, this is so cliche that mm-hmm. female authors are also using this. Like I for one, I don't like doing, you know, as a writer, I didn't want to insert that as someone who's like, here it is for shock value. I wanted
right.
to have some resonance, but I can't stand those kinds of stories where it has either no resonance or what was
point.
It? You and I have talked about like your wife reading like these romance kind of novels.
She's real into like super spicy romance.
Oh,
and there's
yeah.
a lot of
hot.
Like, yeah. There's a lot of that kind of traumatizing kind of sexual assault.
Okay,
I was
yeah.
thinking about the vampire when I read that was like this. That was written by a female author also.
I can't.
Where the girl falls in love with the vampire after he sexually assaults her
right.
like multiple times.
Y'all, there's like this.
And I'm like, this
super,
is disgusting.
Right.
But it's super, it's super. So I learned a term like internalized misogyny. And I was like, interesting. And there is
yeah.
like, but okay. And now we've gone down a rabbit hole and I apologize.
I'm ready for it.
I'm not an expert on any of these things. I am not a professional on any of these things. I'm somebody who likes to read and make sure that I understand a character before I put anything down about them. But there is very much a sense of control that someone feels by taking ownership of a situation that they have no control over, makes sense. And I think what you see in these like romance novels are the ones, what's called dubious consent, I think, or like what you are seeing is almost the like inverse of that, is like women taking control of this like fantasy that has been pushed on us culturally for so long. Like there's sort of this weird that like they're in control even in these situations where they are very obviously not in control at all.
Right.
I don't know.
I think this is just it.
There's so much to unpack here, right?
And
So just to kind of contextualize a little bit, because I don't want to necessarily speak for my wife, because I think she has a lot of like very complex opinions that I don't necessarily understand or share. But I am privy to a lot of conversation between her and her best friend, who lives like four houses down, right? They come over and they talk about these books very loudly from my kitchen almost every weekend. So I'll just be, you know, like chilling in the back, reading my own book, and they're like loudly discussing like, but it wasn't rape at the time, you know, and like it's real intense, right?
Yeah.
It's very intense. But she talks a lot about, you know, some of these situations in her spicy books where there's, you know, some dubious consent or, you know, something like that. And, you know, I think it's really interesting how her perspective is like, you know, the romance for some of these really complicated relationships is, I think it's perceived differently by her based on, you know, kind of what she romanticizes about relationships. And so many of these stories, I think, aren't necessarily about like, oh, well, he assaulted her. It's more complicated than that.
Right.
It's more complex for the characters than that.
Absolutely. He was out of control. I think that's the idea, is the lack of control.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. But that stems from like a, an uncontrollable desire for the other person. A lot of her books are framed with like a kind of like a polyamorous relationship where like the woman is with, they call them a reverse harem. Woman has
a whole slew of men.
Other lovers that she
Which is
she
really the dream,
enjoys.
Honestly.
Right,
exactly. I think that's the idea there. There's a whole genre behind
it. You got a man for every season.
Yeah,
right?
You know, just what are you feeling that day?
Exactly.
And again, I think that that's a response to culturally men being able to have effectively harems or wives and mistresses and it being like a culturally accepted
and it's really important that there's no sense of like you have to, in these books, you don't have to pair up with someone else for your happily ever after, right? Mm-hmm. Like the whole concept is like they can all live harmoniously in this like kind of broad sweeping reverse harem relationship or whatever. And I don't know, if for her it fulfills this like fantasy of
men without like being, ego.
Yes. No, that's exactly right.
Of a
woman
right.
who is appreciated for being herself in such a way that it kind of proliferates through this community of lovers.
Right.
And there's like just this mutual admiration and respect for one another. It's very utopian.
Yeah. Because again, men without egos. And I mean that in the nicest way possible in this room full of men. No. And like, I don't mean to come across any type of way on that front. But like, I think that's the idea, right? Is that in these stories, and I'm saying this like I don't read them, so I can't speak to them. But from my understanding, is that I'm sorry, I'm not gonna say don't. I haven't yet.
Yeah.
Haven't yet read them. You know, life takes you in wondrous directions, and I don't want to commit to anything. But I haven't yet read anything in that vein. But I think a lot of it there is that the idea that there are these multiple like people in your life that respect you and then also are not competing with one another,
right?
Or are not like, you know, it's not vying for anyway.
Yeah, I think too.
It love fulfills, triangle. That's why we see love triangles in stories too, I think.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the stories that she reads anyway, there is a beginning for the character arc that these female protagonists kind of go through, mm-hmm. where a lot of the relationships they begin with are kind of predatory, mm-hmm. or they lack a kind of agency, and the fulfillment of a reverse harem is really like it's a complete restoration of a woman's agency.
Sure.
Right? Like she's able to choose among any lover she wants.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that element of choice is a really powerful catharsis,
yeah.
for a feeling of a lack of agency at other parts of life.
I think it's interesting though, because again, even in that space, you're talking about like lovers. And I think it's interesting that is how we would define our interpersonal relationships. That like that, to your point, right?
Right.
She's come fully full circle as far as agency goes. But when we're talking about agency, it's almost always like sexually connotative. Like that's the story always. There's always a sexual component to that. It's never
in these books for sure.
Right, yeah. Right. It's never just like, oh, like you have fulfilled yourself like
right.
in life. It's like just fulfilling yourself with different dudes, which is totally fine. But it's just a different energy.
It is an interesting allegorical reading for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And I think so to me, I feel like that is kind of the answer to this same question that we were addressing, which is the horror and fantasy lean heavily on like robbing people of their agency.
Yeah.
Right. And all people, to be fair, they do. I mean, that's usually what happens in horror, right? Is that like
sure.
the scary part is that it somehow, some way, we've all been robbed of our agency and a guy with a chainsaw is going to come
right.
and take us out. So I think that's the biggest fear I think culturally we have is being out of control.
Yeah.
And that's what these books do, is allow you to be out of control safely.
So you've done a little bit of work in graphic design and
yeah.
produced, some book covers. How did you kind of get into that aspect of, book creation?
Yeah, accidentally. I think as with all great things, so I started with my own cover. Started with my own stuff because at the time I was getting ready to query and I was like, well, I have an idea of what I want it to look like, and I was learning new programs and I thought it'd be cool to just do that, right? And so I started working on the cover for Wild Things Will Roam. That's actually the cover that's on the book right now. And I've tried to redo it a couple times and I keep coming back to like, no, I like this one. So, why fix something that's not broken? And then that space, so I had signed on originally with a company called Episodic. That was my original publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of Kindlevella before Kindlevella was a thing. And the idea was to deliver episodes that people could read on commute. And so their big target demo was like commuters, people in cars that were going to be able to, on buses and trains, mm-hmm. could read an episode. But then of course the pandemic hit and people stopped commuting. So there was really just like a,
right.
Just a tragic missed timing there. One of the things that ended up happening in that space is that I made a book trailer for myself, and then it was like, well, could we get these for some of the other books? I was like, absolutely. I don't know what I'm doing, so sure. Like, no promises on the quality of the content, but I'm happy to work on it. And so started doing that, and then that ended up just like branching into covers and other things. And it took me, honestly, 2 or 3 years of having actual book covers that I have designed out on people's shelves before I was like, oh, yeah. I do this sort of professionally. Like that sounds so ridiculous. Like there's like 4 or 5 books out there that I've designed covers for. And I'm like, oh no, it's a hobby. But so this year, back to my husband and his infinite wisdom, he was like, hey, you should probably just take it seriously. Like you spend time on it, you're good at it. You should just be unapologetic and be like, oh, hey, like this is a thing I do. So I'm working on that. I'm not great at it yet. I'm still very much like, I'm pretending to be actually good at things, but like, no, I've worked at it. I've learned the skill. And so I'm trying to be better about owning that and saying, hey, I have a skill set. Particular set of skills.
You created an LLC for this, right?
I did. Yeah.
I tried to verb that in the email. I tried. She LLC'd herself.
Myself.
Yeah.
I love it.
I was sitting there like, what does that mean?
Yeah, so I did. I created a, I have my own company is what he's saying. I have a small business that I run in addition to the gym that is also a small business that I run and in addition to the actual job and the kids and all the things. I actually, y'all did the Bram Stoker episode and you were talking about his trapeze act. Like, yeah. And I was like, yo, this resonates. Like, we could have been friends, I feel like, in passing, because we wouldn't have actually had time to hang out. We just would have, like, I see you're doing good things. Have a good day. And, like, walk on our own merry way. Because there would have been no time for conversation.
Didn't you say you also wanted to be referred to as trapeze artist or something?
Like, yeah. That's
it's missed on my opportunity.
No, it's not a missed opportunity. You know, I've got a long life to live. So I've hopefully, if I die tomorrow, then I won't know and it won't matter. But I like to set these like later in life goals because I you guys probably also feel this. I think culturally we feel this. There is this sense of impending doom that's like we're running out of time, right? And so like if I want to do a thing, I have to do it now because I'm running out of time. And I am trying to really lean into the idea that like, I mean, if I do run out of time, again, doesn't matter. But if I don't run out of time, then like I need to have goals for myself for like... So like sewing, for example, that's like in my 40s. Like I'm going to learn to sew in my 40s and I'm going to do an Ironman in my 50s.
I just pictured me, you, Trevor, and Curtis all in our 60s, like with the gray hair, balding, you know, just our easy comfort trousers, and we're all trapezing.
I really hope I'm not balding. No,
we would be balding. The three of us would be balding.
I'm the bald one.
Your hair would just be in one of those like old lady kind of perms.
Sure, right. And I'm Asian, so it'll be like, I'll be like a little old Asian lady by then. Like I transit, I will be young until I'm not. And then it'll just be steep decline.
I just had a birthday, so I'm like having like heat.
Okay, so same. I also had a birthday recently, and it really, it's like, and I'm, I.
Happy birthday to you both.
I understand that I am not actually old. Old time is a construct. It means nothing, whatever. But like this year felt older than other years have felt. And I was like, oh, shit.
That's exactly what Trevor said. He was spent the entire time we went to the movie, and he spent the entire time yelling at these kids.
No joke. We went to see a movie.
Okay.
We went to see Uma.
Okay.
Thurman.
And, yeah.
Uma That's going to be my joke.
And there were these like 10-year-olds or 11-year-olds.
Whippersnappers.
Like, they were sitting right behind us.
Stay off my lawn.
And every 40 seconds, they would just like, they'd get up and they'd go running across the theater because there were only four of us in there.
Right.
And the whole time it was like, it was on my birthday. And I could feel me summoning the get off my lawn kind of like old person. I was like, would you kids shut the fuck up? You know, I was just like so angry.
Yeah. I there's like been a real like cyclical reckoning for me that like you do become your parents and it's not the way you think. Like you, like everybody says that, right? Like, oh, you'll become your mother one day. And like what you realize is that your mom was also very tired and was doing her best. And you're like, oh, huh, there that is. Go figure. But yeah, there's that. I feel that. And same thing with like the idea of like things that used to seem like so boring. Like, oh, I hope I never get there. And now I realize that like, no, you get there and you're happy to be there because you're tired. And again, you're like, I'm just doing my best. I will stay in tonight and drink coffee or wine on my back porch because I pay for this porch, damn it. I might as well. Like, there's just a different energy.
For me, it was, how can somebody sleep in the middle of the day when like they've slept all night? And now it's like, I'm going home. I'm like, oh, it's about nap time.
He leaves work, and as he's out the door, he's like, I'm going to take a nap, knowing that I have to be there for another like 4 hours.
So I low-key, like I'm narcoleptic. So one of the symptoms of that is excessive daytime sleepiness, which is the literal term for it, where you're like, I'm excessively sleepy. And like I learned at one point, like I don't know, I think I had a epiphany one night because I used to come home and nap like at lunch, and then I would come home from work and nap also. And I had this like epiphany that was just like, I'm gonna be tired whether I vacuum my living room or not. Like I'm gonna be just as tired. And then I was like, so I might as well clean this living room. And like, it was literally like a change in my whole personality. Like, I went from being someone who was like, man, I would, but I'm just so sleepy all the time, to being like, no, literally I have a superpower. I can do anything because I'm always tired. So there's no threshold that's like, I need to wait until I'm rested. I will never be rested. So I can just do everything all the time and just sleep less because it doesn't matter anyway. Like, that's really
blowing my mind over here.
That's the energy I bring to the room. So there's more hours in my day, to answer your question about all of the hats. I have more hours in the day. I sleep less.
Awesome.
It
awesome.
Doesn't matter anyway. It's terrible sleep. I hallucinate stuff that's not really there. So it's like, it's not really useful anyway.
That's kind of how I convince myself of any decision I make. I think from the standpoint of someone watching on Alpha Centauri, mm-hmm. right, I will always have done the thing that I'm about to do.
Okay, that is so real. I am living in this mountainscape, and I am just, the future exists.
It was deep, wasn't it, Curtis? Yeah.
No.
Curtis is here, everybody. He's just taking a back seat, but he is here today.
I stole a mic. I also use that Slaughterhouse 5 reference as my like vision for time immemorial, and I'm like, that's fine. That's exactly right. The future exists. I just have to get myself to it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. That's right. So what's next for you, speaking of futures?
Yeah, so I am working on the sequel to Wild Things Will Roam and the prequel to Wild Things Will Roam simultaneously, and they're kind of two sides of the same book, even though one of them takes place in the immediate aftermath of Wild Things Will Roam, like literally picks up 5 minutes later. And then the other one is a prequel that is actually set when Liv is a baby. So, it's been really fascinating. It is more of a... magical realism, women's fiction kind of novel.
Yeah.
So the premise of it is that Dr. Danielle Adams, she's a psychiatrist, and she is kind of in the midst of / on the verge of an affair with the love of her life, who she met when she was 10 years old. And she's got these two small children, and she's like trying to do all of the things, right? Which is something, like I said, like that part's semi-autobiographical. I'm like, oh, I am trying to do all the things except have an affair. But the other stuff I'm doing. So the premise of this novel is that she was born with a freckle in her eye, which is a gift from a Visayan goddess, which is a Filipino goddess, Dalika Mata, who basically puts a freckle in the eyes of children who are gifted with the sight of past, future, and present. Mm. Maybe not in that order. But Danny is a first-generation American. Her dad's from the Philippines. And so she kind of grew up sort of straddling that line of poverty, like the immigrant upbringing. She's an American daughter, which is something her dad calls her kind of cruelly, right? Because she is too American for his taste, but also
kind of a derogatory term.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so anyway, so she's kind of overcoming this and like having to be this feeling of having to be like better in order to be seen. Right. But she has this like vast destiny that she's completely removed from because it's just not culturally ingrained in her. So in the story, the premise is that she has these very vivid imaginings, right, which are premonitions, but she doesn't know that because she was not raised to be a shaman. She was raised to be, like, you know, an American person. Like, she has a regular, she was raised to get a degree and, you know, do well and try to rise up. And so she's sort of straddling this strange line of destiny, which is like trying to force her hand. Like, there are these gods and goddesses who are trying to push her, but she doesn't know that they exist. And she doesn't have that lens at all. And so, like, what that mismatch looks like for her, and then eventually how that leads to some of the events of the collapse. So it's different. It's a different genre than The Collapse, it's a very natural prequel, I think.
Cool. Very cool.
So, yeah.
Very interesting.
So, yeah. So, and I'm getting to explore that Filipino folklore that way, which is real fun for me.
It is amazing.
Yes. So how can people find info on your next projects online?
Yeah, so you can find me at kmwestwrites.com, and then on basically any of the social media places at KM_West_, and you have to put that second one or else you end up with like a real estate company out in California.
Oh yeah, sure.
So so there's double the underscore, but yeah, so you can find me there, and then KM West Creative is my LLC, is my company, so
Awesome.
Yeah, so you can find me there.
Terrific. Maybe. This has been a really, really, really fun interview. We've really enjoyed having you on.
Thank you. And it went a different direction than I expected, but I'm happy to be here. Thanks, guys.
We love it, and we definitely, I can speak for all of us that we would love to have you back.
Absolutely.
Maybe, whenever we can.
Maybe by the time one of these next couple projects come out.
I would love that. I 100%. I love it over here, too, in Fayetteville, so you've sold me.
Just so people don't think we're lying, would you hand the mic to Curtis and so he can say hi to prove that he's here?
Hi, everybody.
See, Curtis is here, everyone.
Had a bit of a rough day yesterday, so I'm going to lay low.
Yeah, he's kind of laying low. So.
I like this. Yeah. That's your radio DJ voice, for sure.
Yeah,
right
yeah.
There.
When I'm on the radio, this is how I talk.
Same. I sound exactly like that when I'm on the radio.
Yeah. Today we're playing all the greatest hits. Yeah. Next up, we got some Led Zeppelin followed by some AC/DC. So
then
hang
Peter
in there,
Gabriel.
Folks.
On Sunday,
Peter
Sunday,
Gabriel.
Sunday.
Shock the monkey!
thank you so much. We've enjoyed having you, and we will all be back later. We're working on the closing, so
I like it.
I like it.